Thank you, Madam Clerk, and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the August 26th meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisors. If you would like some assistance hearing proceedings in chambers, we do have hearing assist devices stored at each end of the dais. And if you would now please rise and join me in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Madam Clerk, no changes to today's agenda, please.
Amendment number one to the August 26, 2014 board agenda. Added item to consent. Item number 21, request by Supervisor Adam Hill to appoint Michael L. Kripe to the Airport Land Use Commission, all districts. Added item to closed session, personnel. It is the intention of the board to meet in closed session to 2, consider public employee appointment for the position of Director of Child Support Services. Requirements of the Brown Act have been satisfied. This notice was posted prior to the 72-hour notice requirement.
Thank you very much, Madam Clerk. With that change to the agenda just read, I have asked staff to actually pull the added consent item number 21 and bring that back at our next regularly scheduled meeting. That is appointments to our airport, an appointment to our Airport Land Use Commission. Our staff report only showed one application for that position, and in fact there were three. A series of miscommunications left out the fact there were two other candidates to be considered. And so what I have asked to have happen is, since District 3 has the airport in it, and since Supervisor Hill has been most actively involved in airport issues, I've asked Supervisor Hill to reach out and have discussions with each of the three candidates, and when we bring this back on September 9th, to bring us back a recommendation for the appointment. So that's how we'll proceed. Ms. Arnold?
Yes. Well, I just want to speak up right here and just assure that the people in other districts know that some of the other supervisors, or at least I can speak for myself, that I'm very interested in also being involved, that it's my opinion that it is a regional airport and it involves all the districts pretty well equally. So we'll all be it's an important position and we'll all be interested in working on it.
And it is a board appointment. And just to bring some structure to the proceedings again, Mr. Hill, I don't know if you had any
No, I'd be happy if Ms. Arnold wants to be involved in the interviews.
That'd
I'll
be great.
Happy to
include
you.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Right. So with that, then, I do have a few requests to speak on the rest of consent. We'll start with Mr. Dave Flynn, followed by Dr. Seehite.
Good morning, Chair. In the next few weeks, however, you know, we continue to send notices to Tyker, the original contractor of the pipeline, demanding that repairs be made. With that, we still will continue to do investigations and look to proceed with a solution this fall. Later in September, we'll be bringing forward to your board a professional services agreement to look towards what that long-term solution will be, as well as looking to bid a project late fall to proceed with a fall during the winter months. Thank you.
Mr. Meacham has a question, I believe.
Dave, I forgot to ask you this yesterday, but how long of the section did Tyker's contract? How much of that pipeline did they have?
Tyker had several miles, the first reach coming down
the first
from Cosmeno Dam, yeah, which probably amounted to about 15 miles.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Flynn. Dr. Height, followed by Eric Greening.
Dr. C. Height, Los Osos. And I just want the public to know where the money's going and where I stand on it. And item one, $100,000 for the Food Bank Coalition, yes. Reminding the public that historically the food bank became very popular when the county was found to have mishandled over 70% of the food stamp applications, and your seniors at home and your disabled still don't know about in-home support services. So you must support the public with a food line. Number five, district attorney. $125,000, continuing administration of the unserved, underserved victim advocacy and outreach program serving elders, dependent adults, and victims with disabilities. Yes, and reminding that historically, one of your witnesses to a crime actually didn't get this kind of service through the district attorney's office, and she certainly was mistreated by county services, your county partners, and she ended up dying. That was a consequence of not being helped. Number nine, Family Care Network, $4,890,000 to provide mental health services, and there is a lot of money in mental health. Number 10, women, infants, and children, $1,255,795. Yes, always yes on this. You can't save money by depriving people of basic nutrition at an early age and deprive mothers of support, because it's all going to end up in the emergency room and it's going to cost you more. Number 12, $689,805 to provide prevention and early intervention behavioral health services to individuals throughout the county. And I just have a really hard time with this whole behavioral health title, and I will be really glad when this whole popularity in this phrasing goes away and it becomes more reasonable and practical, because it's important that you support behavioral health and mental health, but there are people who are suffering mentally because they are victims and they have not exercised their rights. And they are suffering mentally, and when you use the word behavioral health, you assign blame to people who are in poverty. You assign blame to people who are victimized by the priest or a family member, and it's the same way that the church assigned sin to poverty and life problems.
Thank you, Dr. Height. Mr. Greening?
Thank you. I'm Eric Greening, and before I get to item six, which is my main focus, I would just have to say I very much agree with the previous speaker on behavioral health. One can be accused of misbehaving. One is not accused of mishealthing if one has a health condition. So there is accusation and blame in that title. And if we want to get rid of the stigma that's attached to certain illnesses and health conditions, we do need to change that name. Relative to item six, I consider this a very, very appropriate use of congestion mitigation air quality money. I very much urge your support. The Atascadero bike and pedestrian connection very much needs to be made. It is currently a barrier. Bicycles are legally allowed on the freeway simply because they have no other choice. But it's a very ugly place for bicycles to have to be. And the other choice they have right now is to actually cross the river down at Highway 41 and take the back roads, and it's very much a long way, 34%. That has greatly slowed the construction pipeline for the types of projects such as the Templeton-Atascadero connector, the Chorro Valley multi-use trail, and other very much needed connections in our non-motorized circulation. So yes, please do move forward with agenda item six, and also make sure our representatives in Washington are asked very clearly for a restoration of the cut non-motorized funds. It's consistent with our climate action plan and with serving all of the people, including the elders, the youth, and everyone in between. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. That was our last request to speak, so we'll close it to the public, bring it back to the board, and ask colleagues if they have items to pull for separate consideration. Ms. Arnold?
Yes, 7, 9, and 10, and 15 has been taken care of.
7, 9, 10, and 15?
Well, 15, I think we had our explanation from Dave, so I won't pull 15. 7,
okay.
9, and 10.
Mr. Hill?
None, thank you.
Mr. Meacham?
None.
Ms. Ray?
None.
Ms. Arnold, on number 7.
Mm-hmm. So 7 is contract for the completion of the National Environmental Policy Act process to design right-of-way acquisition permits, construction documents, et cetera. And I have no issue with that. This has been in the process for a very long time. The thing that I want to bring up here, though, is we'll be asking, if we approve this contract, Canon to design this connector trail from Morro Bay to Cayucas, and the right-of-way acquisition is what I want to bring up. We've been working here in the county on trails between Santa Margarita and Templeton, and also between San Luis and Morro Bay. In both those cases, I know of at least one incident where private property, or in one case, agricultural operations were interrupted, or possibly could have been interrupted in a very detrimental way. The design of the right-of-way and the word acquisition. I just want to be sure that we're all aware that we need to be sensitive to the private property when we're designing, when this design contract goes out, that we'll be asking for that sensitivity to the private property and the disruption of especially agricultural operations as they design the trail.
Okay. Did you want any staff response on that, or doing this?
Any other
this
comments?
The path does not involve agricultural property at this point.
Just
is that good?
Want to lock that down.
Okay.
So
very good.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now number nine.
Okay, so then number nine. This is our Family Care Network, almost a $5 million contract. And I see Jim and Ann are both in the audience, and I'm going to my million-dollar rule, where I think the public enjoys at least hearing when these vast amounts of money are being given out. So supportive and so appreciative for all the work they do, but I just wondered if one of you might take the podium and just give us a little update on all the work or successes or...
Good morning. Thank you, Supervisor Arnold. Ann Robin, Behavioral Health Administrator. I'm sure that Mr. Roberts can help with some of the more details, but Family Care Network has a number of different programs they provide for children who are severely emotionally disabled in the county. They do excellent collaborative work with both the Behavioral Health Department, Children's Services, as well as the Department of Social Services. They provide intensive foster care treatment within the county. They work a lot with the kin families who need assistance to take care of the children placed in foster care locally. They also provide high levels of therapeutic behavioral health services for kids who need very intensive behavioral-oriented services because of their behaviors, their actual behaviors that are putting them at risk, to maintain their current level of care. They also provide wraparound services, which can be 24/7 therapeutic and behavioral health supports for kids as needed. And then they provide some other ancillary services, all in support of our children who have severe emotional disabilities.
Thank you. And I just think it's important. We have, you know, on any given Tuesday, lots of our taxpayers and constituents listening. And I think it benefits everyone that they know the work you're doing and that, you know, these tax dollars are being allocated to that work. So thank you for that.
Thank you
that.
Very much. Should I just stay here for 10?
Jim Roberts, Director of Family Care Network. I'd just like to add that the mental health services that we provide are really designed to keep children in their families, in the community, in their schools, and really prevent them from going into institutional care. And over the breadth of time that we've been delivering these services here, we've contributed to the reduction of group home placements by 75% in this county. That's a substantial fiscal savings, but it's also a very substantial saving in terms of the emotional impact.
We've been contracting with the State Department of Public Health to provide the WIC program, 100% federally funded services, as you pointed out in your comments, to women, infant, and children, nutritional counseling, breastfeeding counseling, caseload of about 5,000 individuals a month. It's a very collaborative program. We've got WIC clinics at multiple locations throughout our public health sites throughout the county. And the one interesting policy question going on in California at the State Department of Public Health relative to WIC is they're contemplating, broadening the solicitation for proposals starting next fiscal year. For years, the state has simply turned to its counties and other community-based organizations providing WIC services to continue to do so year after year after year. And I think the federal government is looking to the State Department of Public Health to take a fresh look at how WIC services might best be delivered. So the potential exists for us to have to submit a proposal this year for the subsequent fiscal year's funding, and we'll be briefing your board and the CAO's office on that process.
Thank you.
So thank you.
Yeah. Good.
Thank you. And with that, then, I would entertain a motion on consent absent item 21.
So moved.
Thank you, Mr. Hill.
Second.
Thank you, Ms. Ray, I guess, by a hair. Madam Clerk, a roll call vote, please.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Ray?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
And Mr. Gibson?
Yes. Thank you. That brings us then to public comment items not on our agenda within the purview of the board. We'll go with the slips that are at the dais right now, which number 9. We'll start with Greg Shearer, followed by Eric Greening.
Good morning. My name is Greg Shearer, and I'm here to invite all of you supervisors to an event that it's taking place this Sunday in San Luis Obispo. It's a benefit concert for the Veterans Express. The Veterans Express, as I'm sure most of you know, is a transportation service for veterans that have medical issues but no means of transportation. And we've been in operation since 2008, and all funding for this service is donated through private donations and fundraising efforts that I try to put on. And I would like to invite each and one of you to attend a concert this Sunday at the Grange Hall in San Luis Obispo, 2880 Broad Street. And Rio Salinas will be performing at the concert and featuring our well-known local artist, Louis Ortega. So we're pretty excited about that, and I'd sure like to see if you guys can make it. Take a nice day off before Sunday football kicks in the following week. Thank you very, very much.
A day off before watching football. I like that. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Shearer.
Thank you.
Thank you for your efforts on behalf of this project. Appreciate it. Mr. Greening, followed by Dr. Seehite.
Yes, I am Eric Greening, and recently I was at the Department of Planning and Building website. I remembered that in the comment letters on the Phillips 66 track extension, which there is actually called the Santa Maria Refinery Track Extension, if you go looking for it, you don't see the words Phillips 66. But anyway, I wanted to visit a document that one of the commenters had placed in there for other purposes. And I was very interested when I got into the comment letters to see that now this comment letter, and it turns out all the comment letters I looked at, are decorated along the right margin with these red bars and then this sort of code thing that with letters and numbers such that one sees in a final environmental impact report keyed to responses to comments. That would seem to indicate that responses to comments have been already prepared and that some document that includes them is about to be turned loose. And that raises two questions. The smaller question is, so soon there were some huge tasks that the consultants were taking on, such as examining hundreds of miles more railroad track for safety hazards than they had done in the original draft, for example. And it's hard to believe that that work has been completed, even though I still don't think it's adequate to go from Colton to Roseville and call it a day when most of the oil would be coming from out of states and perhaps even out of country. And we don't have that yet. Thank you,
Mr. Greening. Dr. Hite, followed by Ben DeFata.
Dr. C. Hite, Los Osos. Not for ourselves alone. Notice how the county seal didn't make it into the new county government center. The county motto, not for ourselves alone, is within your purview. When you make decisions that affect our quality of life, it is your responsibility to set the example and to oversee your employees, providers, and county partners, not just pay the bills. Example, there was such poor management in social services that the county sued itself to get a handle on rampant sexual harassment. Example, you almost lost your HUD grant, yet many of us who are unfunded brought you real solutions which you ignored to bring housing security to Los Osos. The housing authority only had to send a letter to HUD to allow renters to buy their homes. So where are we all these years later? Because that was 2010 when I brought that information to you. Well, I couldn't foresee this. All these years later, it is the housing authority that is acting as a manager that has jacked up security deposits on long-term tenants who are good tenants and also raised rents. This was unforeseeable that your tenants of Los Osos would have their security deposits doubled, tripled, almost quadrupled. And, you know, if you can vote us McDonald's people, you can urge our District 2 supervisor to do the right thing. You sit quietly while the people of Los Osos come forward and tell you about our plight. And no one actually inquires or takes the steps that need to be done to see that that the people of Los Osos are not just really wiped off the map. And Gwen Taylor was correct when she predicted the economical cleansing of Los Osos. Well, what really scares me is that I'm a researcher, and didn't take much to click a mouse and go on the HUD website. And I actually am very frightened to see that, no, I don't believe the Housing Authority can raise the rents. They keep claiming state law, but state law that doesn't apply to Section 8 tenants applies to just regular tenants. And if it is true that the Housing Authority is not within their rights to triple these deposits, how does that look that you almost lost your HUD grant, and yet your partner agency comes through and just impoverishes the tenants that they manage? Don't own the complexes, just mismanage them. So think about this. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Hagen. Zafada, followed by Julie Tacker.
Good morning, Board, Sheriff, Public. I am Ben Zafada from Los Osos. No wonder this town is considered the happiest place in the country. Why, just here in the center of town, there must be at least 50 to 100 places that serve booze, mostly to students and tourists to drink or have fun. Taking a page from Supervisor Gibson or Auger's playbook and a couple of others in the past, this place should be called Slow Peyton Place, Slow Playboy Club, or Slow Good Old Boys Club, because from the top down, starting with you supervisors on down to managers and or departments, it's monkey see, monkey do, or do as I say, not as I do, regarding personal relations with county employees. The latest one was several months ago, down in the Royal Grande late one night in a darkened building to save electricity, I guess.
Mr. Zafada, I'd ask you to stay on matters of the purview of the Board of Supervisors.
I got you involved in this, too.
Thank you. Please stay on topic.
Please turn the clock off.
No, we're going to keep going.
Go. So say again what's your...
I want you to speak on a matter not on the agenda within the purview of the Board of Supervisors.
Purview, is that your word, sir?
Subject matter jurisdiction is the Brown Act's word.
Chill out, Bruce. This is not... You're involved in this, too. You Board are an example of all everybody below you. You're the worst people, not all of you. Sorry. Okay, I'll get away from that investigation. Then that same city manager sent a memorandum to the city council recommending a 3% increase for the county's lawyer for legal services rendered in this matter.
Again,
then the mayor recommended
Zafada,
that the city council approve a 10%. On top of that, the mayor found...
Mr. DeFatta, on matters under the purview, subject matter jurisdiction of the Board of Supervisors.
You made that word up. So, in private industry, you would be demoted or fired for compromising something with the competitors or
handled an hour's worth of traffic on their scanners. Our cooperative agreements with Cal Fire backed up those firemen when they had to go to City Hall at Arroyo Grande. Mr. Gibson, it's all in our purview. Nacimiento pipeline leaking affects multiple cities and county jurisdictions along the pipeline. Phillips 66 affects hundreds, if not thousands, of cities and communities along the track. Huckfest, right here on the beach in Oceano, will affect Grover, Arroyo, Oceano, Nipomo. The traffic backs up. The police, the sheriff's department, your sheriff's department will be involved. I'm very worried about District 4 because of what's going on down there. And I believe Phillips 66, the Huckfest, the scandal in the city of Arroyo Grande are within your purview. So, Mr. Gibson, to interrupt Mr. DeFatta is inappropriate. To take his 3 minutes of time, that's all he came here for, is to give you 3 minutes of his time in a county that you are the chairman of the board for. It's in your purview. An irony that I find is that county taxpayer dollars are being spent on the Paso Robles Basin, yet my community, the inequity in my community, is only the prohibition zone pays for the mitigation of the Los Osos groundwater basin. The prohibition zone is paying for the repair of the roads that every one of you drives on.
Thank you, Ms. Tacker. Ms. Owen, followed by Gary Kirkland.
Good morning, Lindy Owen from Los Osos. And I object to Mr. Gibson's interruption of, I think what Mr. DeFatta was trying to make the connection is monkey see, monkey do. Arroyo Grande is having the same problem that Mr. Gibson, you had when you had your affair, and Mr. Pava Ogren when he had his affair, and how county council decides that there's not a problem there and we just move on. That is not acceptable. That is not acceptable behavior, and it's not a good solution at all. I want to move on to the continued contracting more money for the repair of Nacimiento. Now, I want to try to make the connection to the problem in Los Osos is Nacimiento had oversight. It had people watching the construction of their miles of pipeline put in. That is simply a water pipe that carries mercury-polluted water from a lake that's half empty most of the time. But what's happened in Los Osos is we're putting in 42 miles of pipes that are supposed to carry raw sewage, that are supposed to run through our upper aquifer, that are in a seismic activity liquefaction zone, and we had zero oversight. The project is about $200 million versus $178 million, I think, was Nacimiento. Why did Nacimiento have oversight and something much more complicated, like the sewer in Los Osos, get zero oversight and continues to have no oversight? We haven't had an update. We have cost overruns going, you know, escalating up into, you know, $250 million sewer. We have a $15 million lawsuit. Mr. Gibson, where is the update? Why are we not knowing what is the situation? I know you assume that it's just Los Osos that's responsible for this, but it is countywide that the cost overruns and the lawsuits may end up landing on county taxpayers also. Plus, it's just bad management. This county has done a terrible job at that. We're looking at pipes that were installed. I mean, even just the procedure of how this pipe sewer was put in. You put the pipes in, you go up, you put up the Broderson leach field so that as the pipes are going in, the water that we could have saved was to be put in there. Oh, no, it was too expensive at the last minute to do that, even though it was calculated that that would be done. Now we're building the treatment plant. Why is the treatment plant being built after the pipes have been installed? We're wasting water from drinking supply to water vegetation on Broderson, that leach field site that I'm talking about, when we couldn't put water on the downtown site. This is total mismanagement, and we've got numerous problems that continue. Streets have been torn up. Nothing is looking like it's finished. And I tell you what, when we have our earthquake, every one of those pipes is going to break
Ms. Owen.
And leak.
Mr. Kirkland, followed by Richard Margetson.
Thank you very much. What I want to talk about is something that happened in Napa Valley the other day. They had an earthquake, and I see that there's a report that some people think that Diablo Canyon is not safe and they want to close it down until it is, quote, safe, which there's no such thing as safety. You could hit by a meteor. There's no way to be safe at any time. And Diablo Canyon, from a cost-benefit point of view, has been hugely beneficial to this county. And I've toured it, and I think I've talked about this before. I toured it back in the 80s, and they overbuilt the place for earthquake safety. But if you're wanting absolute safety, you'll never find it. And for those people who are afraid of dying from nuclear waste, I suggest they use a 45 or a 38 or something of that nature. And that way they won't ever die of nuclear waste or anything of that. Thank you.
Mr. Margetson, followed by Jeannie Blackwell.
Richard Margetson. So at what point that award that the Nacimiento project received upon its completion, what point does that get returned? Statewide award for how wonderful the project was. What I really came to talk about today, though, was the lack of attention paid to Los Osos by, I guess, this board at this point, the Tribune, basically the powers that be. Article in the paper this weekend about water conservation across the county. A little chart on the front page. Rio Grande, Morro Bay, Cambria. Some were CSDs, some were cities. Los Osos isn't on that chart. No mention in the article. We have a known seawater intrusion issue. It's not disputed. There's disputes in North County. There's disputes in South County. There's no dispute in Los Osos that we have a seawater intrusion issue affecting the only source of water in Los Osos. No coverage. I come here repeatedly, ask for somebody to stand up and take a proactive advancement of the water conservation program with respect to the Los Osos wastewater project. Nothing. There's been a paltry increase in the number of toilets replaced since the beginning of this fiscal year. This last Friday, John Diodati from county staff was at the Scenic Coast Association of Realtors meeting to talk about water issues on the coast. It was talked for about 40 minutes. 2 minutes on Los Osos. Basically said the wastewater project will be online in 2016. All of the water, 100% of the water coming from the plant will be used for beneficial reuse. 60 acre feet going to dryland farmers is beneficial reuse when it has no impact on seawater intrusion. You wonder why we come every week? Because eventually somebody listens. Recently, and that somebody recently, is Sierra Club. Your office, I hope it got to your office or county staff, Sierra Club has now recently sent a letter questioning and asking for a proactive response to the Los Osos Water Conservation and Reuse Program, believing it's inadequate The leading unit needs to be adjusted now to help save the basin.
Thank you, Mr. Margetson.
When does that come
Thank you,
before
Mr.
this
Margetson.
Board?
Ms. Blackwell.
Hi, Jeannie Blackwell, San Luis Obispo. Quick recap. On May 20th, an entourage of concerned citizen students from Cal Poly and Cuesta College graced this chamber. We presented over 5,000 signatures from students, local farmers, residents, business owners, visitors from across the state and around the world. Letters from your peers, San Luis Obispo City Council, Aurora Grande City Council, and more recently, Cambria Community Service District, calling on the San Luis Obispo Governing Board to join us securing our quality of life and standard of living and banned fracking. We call on you to use your executive and legislative quasi-judicial powers to ban, bar, an insidious destructive process that would require that would quite unapologetically waste billions of gallons of our scarce water to shamelessly pry the last and better remains of an era long since laid to rest. Since Acceleron, so many years back, made the request to frack in Wasna, it is still not safe. Oil industry still refuses to comply with the Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, and the Safe Drinking Water Act. Is there another industry here that has the luxury of refusing to comply with Clean Air, Clean Water, and the Clean Drinking Water Act? Does the wine industry, ag, farmers, ranchers, restaurants, hospitals get to say, no, I'm not going to comply because they're exempt through the Halliburton loophole? Sunday, Mother Nature caused an earthquake, jarred California's wine capital, caused $1 million in damages. Nine water mains broke, triggered fires that and ruptured gas lines. We have a $3 billion wine, agriculture, and tourist industry. Can we really afford to have man-made earthquakes? In an explosive document kept secret for more than a year, a former federal inspector charged that Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant in California is more vulnerable to earthquakes than initially known and should be shut down until PG&E can prove it is its safety. Not that we have to prove it is unsafe. PG&E can prove its safety. Fracking causes earthquakes. Ohio geologists reported small swarms of earthquakes in the state appear to be linked to fracking wells. According to a new study in Journal Science, an increase in the number of earthquakes in Chinsor, Oklahoma, likely rises the rise of underwater injection wells to dispose of treated wastewater from oil and fracking operations. Earthquakes increased tenfold in Texas when they started fracking. We sit on a matrix of fault lines. We are in an active earthquake zone. Diablo Canyon is not safe from earthquakes. Fracking is not safe. It can cause earthquakes. Can Freeport prove fracking is safe? No. We want fracking banned until it can be proved safe. And if it was safe, they wouldn't need Halliburton loopholes to stay in business. When we waive their exemption, when they waive their exemptions, we Thank will you. Remove our ban.
Thank you, Mr. Blackwell.
What about the water to be Thank continued? Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you, Ms. Blackwell. That was our last request to speak, so we'll close public comment. Items not on the agenda. Mr. Buckshy, would you advise the public? You reminded me yesterday when we were going to bring an informational item back on fracking and other oil recovery techniques.
Yes, Dan Buckshy, County Administrator. A couple months back, your board directed staff to look into the issue and provide an update. We are planning to do that on September 23rd.
Very good. Thank you, sir. With that.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Ms. Arnold.
In response to some of the public comments, it came to me when I walked in the room this morning and was asked a question on the Los Osos project that I didn't know the answers, admittedly, and that I haven't been updated on that project in a long time. So I'm wondering if any of my other colleagues, I know I can ask for a briefing on that project privately, but I wonder in the interest of transparency if some of my other colleagues would want to ask for another update on the Los Osos project to be a public presentation similar to the fracking presentation we'll be having on September 23rd.
Colleagues, Public Works staff is always happy to come and talk to you individually. There are no specific decision points in the next few months. I can consult with the project team and see at what point a board item might be appropriate. But construction proceeds apace on the treatment plant. We will be doing some public outreach later this year and making some decisions on getting set up for the connections to the system in early 2015. So unless you have particular issues that you feel you'd like to bring forward before the board as a whole, I think there's really not much but the status quo to report. Ms. Bray?
I just wanted to comment that I think that we're going to get that. Dan, maybe you could remind us about the upcoming, I don't know what to call it, water summit or whatever, and we're going to get updates on the basins at that time as well. Not necessarily the project, but some of the crowd brought up the issue of the health of the basin itself. Maybe you could comment on what we're planning with Supervisors Hill and Meacham.
Yeah, Dan Buckshay, again, County Administrator. As a little bit of background, a few weeks back, Supervisor Meacham had raised the idea of holding a water information session, water summit, something along those lines, and he and Supervisor Hill had agreed to work with staff to craft something. What we are targeting, just basically decided yesterday after we discussed it further, is that the afternoon of October 14th, which is a board strategic planning session, we would hold that study session on water, a high-level agenda, which is subject to further refinement at this point, is that we would have the drought task force provide an update regarding current issues in the county as a result of the drought, what we're doing about it, as well as our emergency preparedness and response. We would provide a one-year look-ahead, similar to what Public Works did a couple weeks ago, and look at doing that from water supply as well from agriculture. Look to have our state lobbyist here to talk about water legislation in Sacramento, the Pavley Dickinson bill, the water bond, and anything else that might be germane to our discussion, and also have our federal lobbyist here to talk about what's occurring at the federal level. So that is the target at this point, and more detail will be forthcoming soon.
Just to clarify, for me, I'm anxious to hear both of the presentations on fracking and on the drought condition, but I think what I'm asking for is if my colleagues would agree to a similar presentation on just a comprehensive update on the Los Osos Sewer Project. And for the sake of transparency and answering questions, just to catch us up on how the project's going, I wouldn't know if some of these comments made today are true or not true. So I sure would love to be updated on how the project just generally is going. And I'm asking you all for permission to do that publicly.
Mr. Hill?
Yeah, I do not I do not accept Ms. Arnold's framing of this. We spent this board several years on the project, having reports almost monthly in the beginning. All of the decision points, particularly about money and project status, have been made. I know that there are people who come and are unhappy at every point of the decision process about the sewer. If you feel like you need to answer their questions, and I would recommend that you have a briefing from Public Works. We do not do this with every single project. Once we've passed all of the decision points in the project, my understanding is well on its way toward completion in 2016. So, you know, it's not about transparency. It's about whether you want to come up to speed on the project yourself or not.
You may leave, Ms. Owen. Thank you. As I recall my staff discussions yesterday, the next actual action item on the Los Osos project is going to be an item coming to the board to talk about the setting and possible waiving of building permit fees for the connection process, and we're scheduled for that early in 2015. So, lacking any other actions, I think that would be the appropriate time. Mr. Meacham?
I guess the other question is, that continues to linger out there is the water conservation issue, and I don't know what point will be.
Well, despite Mr. Margetson's assertions, you may now leave. Mr. Margetson, you're disrupting the meeting. You may leave. Thank you. So, despite his repeated assertions as to its failure, it is well underway and target to be complete. So, we can wrap that into an item that might come early next year. So, with that, and seeing no board majority interested in a particular Los Osos item, I will ask Madam Clerk to introduce the next one, please.
Item number 17, request to approve a three-year contract, August 26, 2014 through August 25, 2017, with Transitions Mental Health Association in the total amount of $1,860,098 for housing placement and supportive services for chronically homeless individuals, and authorized a corresponding budget adjustment in the amount of $578,719 from Social Services Realignment Funds to Fund Center 180, Department of Social Services, to fund the initial year of the contract, all districts.
Good morning, Ms. Jackson.
Good morning. I'm Emily Jackson from the Administrative Office, here to present on this item. And before I get started, the clerk noted an issue with the contract, and so I need to correct that for the record right now. Appendix A, which is the contract itself, did not appropriately reference Exhibit G of the contract, which is included in the board's packet and is part of the contract that was signed by County Council and by Transitions Mental Health Association. And so I've provided a replacement page to the clerk to remedy that issue. So this item is a long time coming, and it's a really exciting day as we're starting to see the collaborative efforts of several different organizations come together. First, I'll touch on how we got to where we are today, including a discussion in this policy shift that we've been seeing at the federal level with respect to how communities address issues of homelessness. Then I'll turn it over to Jill Bolster-White, the executive director from Transitions Mental Health Association, who will talk a bit about program design. We'll talk a bit about program reporting and documentation, as those are going to be very important to ensuring this, measuring the success and determining whether or not this is something we'd like to continue doing out years. And then we'll talk a bit about the creation of the vulnerability index that is going to identify and prioritize people for housing. So, back in November, we introduced the idea of a housing-first approach to addressing homelessness. Until recently, housing-ready had been the prevailing approach at the federal level, and under the housing-ready approach, the focus was on treating homeless people before they were moved into housing, meaning that the idea was that people needed to be well before resources were dedicated towards housing them. Unfortunately, there's quite a few issues with that approach, and one of those is that what happens oftentimes is that when you're treating people during the day, when services terminate after business hours, you're basically placing them back out on the streets, and you're putting them into an unstable and sometimes dangerous and somewhat nerve-wracking environment for folks to be living in. And so what happens when you do that is that you kind of reverse everything that happened during the treatment day, or you at least don't provide people with an environment in which to maintain whatever they've gained from treatment during that day. And so in recognizing that sort of issue, back in 2009, Congress enacted the Hearth Act, which strongly encouraged a housing-first approach, which and that's kind of a flip from housing-ready. And so what housing-first does is it places people into housing first without any requirement that they be well, and then it wraps services around them in order to help them maintain and stabilize their housing. And so given the fact that that's been successful in so many communities, we're seeing a push at the federal level, and Housing First has really become a favored approach in addressing issues of homelessness, especially issues of chronic homelessness within communities. And we're seeing a lot of encouragement from HUD along those lines to kind of move in that direction. So part of the reason that Housing First has become a best practice is that the experience of other communities has demonstrated that it's cost-effective and that it reduces the per-client cost of chronically homeless individuals. So this chart is from a study that Los Angeles did a number of years ago, and what it shows is over on the right side is the cost of essentially keeping somebody homeless, a chronic homeless person homeless for a single month. And then on the left is the cost of actually putting them into permanent supportive housing, so housing them first and then wrapping services around them. And what Los Angeles saw was that once you put people into housing, they greatly reduce their reliance on various community services like the jails, other incarceration settings, ERs, just hospital stays in general, use of emergency transport and other services that the community provides. Now, national studies seem to suggest that about 10% of the homeless population uses about 50% of the homeless services resources, and so that kind of follows with this chart. The idea is that you've got some really sick folks who don't have housing, and they're the ones that we pay the most attention to, and you know, our resources are often directed towards this rather than directing it to other segments of the homeless population. And so, you know, I think it's beyond that, it's sort of important to identify that when we're talking about a reduction in costs, a lot of these are actually going to be sunk costs. So this doesn't mean that we're going to see, you know, a 79% overall reduction in our costs. Some of these are community costs. But what we're going to see is that resources will hopefully be freed up to redirect to other segments of the population, whether they be homeless or not. And it's also important to remember that, of course, these aren't all direct county costs. Some of these are costs provided by other organizations with a community. So, given that, the county's 10-year plan to end homelessness identifies the implementation of a housing first model of supportive housing as a goal in our efforts to address issues of homelessness locally. And so last year, the Homeless Services Oversight Council, or HSOC, went through a strategic planning effort in which they identified a focus on housing first as being a priority for the near term, consistent with recent direction provided by HUD. And so in order to move to this housing first model, HSOC voted to join the 100,000 Homes Campaign, which is a national effort which uses a vulnerability index to prioritize individuals for supportive housing. So the vulnerability index, and I'll talk a bit about that in a minute, is a tool that sort of identifies people who are at high risk of dying on the streets and of not being well out on the streets. And it prioritizes them for housing based on several different factors, including physical health, the severity of mental illness, especially those who have co-occurring substance abuse and chronic health condition disorders, those who have frequent hospitalizations, and then also identifies folks who are older, which the vulnerability index considers to be over the age of 60. And so, on advice from other communities that have joined the 100,000 Homes campaign, what we've seen is that public-private partnerships are really key to, and significant community collaboration is really key to ensuring the success of this program. And so the contract before the board today is very representative of that, and that's part of the reason that that Transitions Mental Health was selected to provide these services, and Jill will speak to that in a bit. But so this all began, again, with the prioritization by HSOC and then the identification that participating 100,000 Homes campaign was the way to go. And so last year, HSOC identified and set a goal of housing 50 chronically homeless individuals, which locally is equivalent to about 10% of our chronically homeless population. So it's a fairly significant dent in some of the issues that we're dealing with. In order to assure the success of this program, HSOC did a needs assessment and identified the necessary community resources that would need to be dedicated towards this effort. And so the Housing Authority very early on stepped up with a very generous offer to dedicate 50 of their housing choice vouchers to this effort. Those housing choice vouchers are going to be used to cover rent costs for clients housed under this program. And so the county kind of went back to the table and said, okay, what can we contribute to this effort? And what we discussed with you in November was the fact that the county could either in-house provide a variety of supportive services, including case management or mental health supports, public health supports, or that we could contract out for that. And so we, based on board direction back in November, we developed an RFP. It was released in March The RFP was developed by the administrative office, but within collaboration from other departments within the county, and it was vetted as well by the City of San Luis Obispo, the Housing Authority, and our partners up in Santa Clara County, which have actually been incredibly successful in implementing this Housing First model. So, like I said, the RFP was released in March. Submittals were due back in mid-April, and we only received one proposal. The proposal was from Transitions Mental Health, and they designed a very, very comprehensive program, which they named 50 Now, and so that's what's before the board today. So despite the fact, though, that only one proposal came in, we did extensively review it. Not only did the county review it, but it was reviewed also by Haslo and the city as well to get their buy-in and their input on program design. And the overall consensus was really that TEMA had done a really good job. They had prepared a really, really solid proposal, and based on their program design and their track record, we identified them as the best possible provider of these supportive services, and we entered into contract negotiations with them. So, there we go. The contract before your board today is for an initial term of 3 years with a total cost of $1.86 million over 3 years. The initial cost is going to be about $578,000 in the first year, and that ramps up a bit as they get more and more people into housing and they engage with more and more clients. Under the contract, TEMA is actually going to subcontract with CAPSLO, and they're going to be providing housing placement and supportive services. And again, Jill will talk about that in a moment. One of the things that Jill will also touch on is the collaborative nature of this contract and this program as a whole. Like I said, that was really one of the reasons that TEMA's proposal was so strong. It represented really strong and high level of community collaboration. They included letters of support from CAPSLO, from the Housing Authority, Five Cities Homeless Coalition, ECHO, community health centers, and some local landlords. And this collaboration, as you'll see, is going to be carried through into program design. Similarly, reporting and documentation is going to be central to this contract, as the ability to measure our success is central to the requirements that we've laid out in the contract, and I'll touch on that in a bit. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to Jill.
Ms. Bolster-White.
Hello, everyone. Jill Bolster-White from Transitions Mental Health Association. Emily did a great job of sort of laying out, you know, what happened up to the point that Transitions Mental Health Association put together our response. So we saw the RFP. We were appropriately daunted by what it described and outlined, and immediately just drew on a collaborative. There was really no other way to sort of tackle a project like this other than to talk to our partners and talk to the folks that we've worked with. So some things I think that are unique to Transitions Mental Health Association is we have a 35-year history of working throughout San Luis Obispo County, North County to South County. We have provided supported permanent housing for folks during all of that time, and we also have some existing formal and informal relationships with all the people who we got letters of support from. And, of course, the key to this is housing, and that's something I think we've done very well. We manage about 200 beds of housing as an organization as it stands right now. So it seemed that all those elements, along with getting the support from our partners, were really what made us feel confident enough to move forward and submit the proposal. So I just want to talk a little bit about what some of the background is, and we talked about this in our response. Some of the unique experience that we have is we've had a HUD-funded program and a very close partnership with the Housing Authority for 16 years. So we've had a transitional homeless housing program where we've worked with the voucher system, we've worked closely with the Housing Authority, and that also has included CAPSLO. So I think that gave us a great template that we could approach this. The other couple of projects that we've had were the homeless outreach team, and that was a more recently funded project that was funded by the Mental Health Services Services Act, where it was a very grassroots, intensive engagement where you basically deploy a group of people into the community. They work with local law enforcement folks. They work with some of the local groups, Five Cities, Echo, and Capslo, and basically find people where they are in the community. So you're not sort of, you're bringing people in, drawing people in over time into the settings where they can receive services. Because as I think we know, it's not successful to expect that people will walk in the doors of some of our more formal services. And so that's really the key, is that engagement and rapport. And the one thing we've talked a lot about with this program is that you do have to have a very long-term view. And that's why we requested a three-year program. Our experience has really shown that there's no way we would be able to deliver the kind of outcomes that we all would want over a 12-month period. So we do talk a little bit in the RFP. It's sort of long. I don't know if you've all gotten to read it. But we, what we really want to do is take the list that's been accumulated through the group of folks who's going through the vulnerability index, and I know we're going to talk about that in a little bit, but really basically to engage, to try to interview and engage with all the people on that list. Simultaneously, we're going to be convening our stakeholder group, and so that will include the Housing Authority, of course, the county departments, Behavioral Health, Department of Social Services. Laurel Weir will be part of that, Elaine Archer and Scott Smith from the Housing Authority, Jana Nichols and Bill Watt from their groups, Grace McIntosh from CAPSLO. So we really wanted to make sure we had the stakeholder group meeting frequently and talking about this group of people and what our approach is. So that way, I feel like the county will be well engaged and be very knowledgeable about what the process is, who might have moved out of town. You know, who do we have engaged already, maybe in behavioral health, or who's, you know, who is doing what and who is where. I think that's going to be the key element to begin with. So we talk a little bit in our RFP about convening that committee, and that's actually going to be, if we're able to get the contract signed and authorized, that will really be job one, is to get our stakeholder committee together to review the list and then come up with our game plan. I think the other benchmarks that we talk about are actually housing people. I think we were hoping within the first 9 months to actually get 17 people placed in housing. I won't make that sound like that's going to be the easiest thing in the world. The housing inventory right now is at one of the tightest points that it's been in many, many years. I actually spoke to a person who's a landlord who has Section 8 certificates, and he said, you know, I think I'm going to be pulling out of that program because I can get more on the private market. And so we are running afoul of the market. But the good news is I think we do have some good and longstanding relationships with landlords, and I know CAPSLO does as well. So I think we're going to be really wanting to make sure that a big part of the grant is really making sure that we smooth out costs, that we really prepare people for housing, and that we maintain those good relationships with landlords. I wanted to talk a little bit about our team design. One of the things we've learned in our homeless outreach program in particular is that you really need to have a team that is has a variety of specialties. So we know from our past experience, drug and alcohol issues, mental health issues, health issues. I think when we first started working in homeless services as an organization, I think I was surprised at how many health issues were really the first thing that we needed to deal with, that was sort of treating somebody's cataracts or untreated cancer. You know, there were some very significant health issues that were presenting. And so for that reason, our team includes a registered nurse. It includes a person with drug and alcohol experience, a licensed therapist to help us navigate the mental health system, and people with lived experience with mental illness. I know that that's been something at Transitions Mental Health Association that's been a long-standing goal. It is an evidence-based practice that actually people who've been through homelessness and mental health treatment and drug and alcohol treatment are very successful in engaging with folks who are in the middle of that experience and living with homelessness. So we found those to be very successful components of some of our existing programs, and we're definitely planning to employ that here. Okay, I guess if we can move to the next slide, that would be great. Or did I miss a slide? Okay. Sorry. Thank you. So this slide talks a little bit about some of the initial steps we plan to take, which is to evaluate client needs and provide services. Again, I think some strengths that Transitions Mental Health Association brings to the table is we have many years of experience in case management, and we certainly think that that is a major element for success, is having somebody who can help the folks who will be serving sort of organize themselves and get back on the path to stability and to being housed. Healthcare services are very critical, as you, Emily, noted. Community health centers provided a letter of support. We've long partnered with them in their homeless health services project, and so we feel very confident and comfortable that we'll have a good relationship with them, and that we will, with our own nurse on the team and their health services, that we'll be able to address some of the healthcare needs that the clients will have. And then I think we're also known for employment. That's another really elemental part of this, is it, when people need to find work, it can be a struggle. They're competing with Cal Poly students. They're competing with people who don't have big gaps in history on their resumes, and so employment is something that Transitions Mental Health Association has a very good history in providing. And then, as noted, County Behavioral Health Services will continue their partnership, and for folks who've been diagnosed with mental illnesses, they will be providing that level of treatment in concert with our staff. This slide describes the stakeholder group, and as I mentioned, this is a significant project, and it has some daunting elements to it, and so there really isn't a great way of having it be successful without bringing everybody to the table. And so this describes the stakeholder group. It would be the staff of the 50 Now program, including the staff hired by CAPSLO, the Housing Authority, the county departments who are involved, the ECHO shelter folks, Five Cities Homeless Coalition, Jan is in the audience, and then partners as needed. We know there are People's Kitchen, Food Bank, there are a lot of groups that end up providing a lot of support and services, and so we'll be including those folks, but this group will be the core of the stakeholder group. And then we also have talked a lot about what we're hoping and expecting the outcomes to be. And we do want to make sure that our reporting is inclusive and robust. As I mentioned, I think for the first year of the project, we'll really be talking about everybody that we've engaged with. I think Emily's going to talk a little bit about the process of identifying the folks on that list, and I think there are over 200 people on the list now. We know that there's going to be some fluidity to that, that people may move out of the area, they may find housing on their own, so we want to make sure that we're really intentionally discussing all of those elements and reporting on them. Speaking of reporting, Transitions Mental Health Association does have extensive existing experience on Medi-Cal. We're involved in the HMIS, the Homeless Management Information System, through our HUD-funded project, and all the Mental Health Services Act reporting that comes with our mental health contracts. So it should we will be providing robust reporting on these folks, and we're hoping to actually exceed some of the outcomes we've had in some of our previous homeless projects, where we have had impressive outcomes in reducing jail stays by 67%, by reducing psychiatric hospitalizations by 70%, and really trying to maintain people within this, basically within our staff and within the services that are being deployed specifically to this program. So I'm ready to turn it back over to you.
Thanks, Jill.
But I'll be here for questions, of course.
So I wanted to touch a little bit on the reporting and documentation issue that Jill brought up. One of the things that we're going to be doing, like I mentioned in the beginning, is that communities have seen a reduction in the per client cost once they've housed people, and so that's something that we intend to be closely tracking. A lot of the performance measures, which are copied and pasted right out of the contract into the staff report, kind of get at that concept. And so
One of the things that we're going to be doing is that the county is going to be working very closely with Transitions Mental Health on kind of determining that pre and post client cost. You know, until we formally know who everybody on the list is and we know what their issues are, it's a little bit difficult to say what does a person cost today, because that's going to vary from person to person. But despite that, we've been doing some groundwork to kind of get ready for contract implementation. And so Laurel Weir, our homeless services coordinator, has been doing a lot of this work. She's been working with the various institutions, whether it be the jail, the hospitals, emergency medical services providers, and others who interact with homeless clients on a daily basis. And she's been working with them to kind of obtain the necessary documentation and to get everything in place so that once the contract is up and running, that we'll be able to share information among agencies, being mindful of all the privacy rules and HIPAA compliance and everything related to that. They've also been working on sort of developing a standard methodology for measuring these pre and post client participation costs. And so Laurel can speak to that if there's any questions along those lines. So like Jill and I both noted, clients housed under this program will be housed off of a registry list. This is consistent with the 100,000 Homes campaign model. And so the registry list is being created and maintained by the County Department of Social Services. Social Services, under the leadership of Laurel, has kind of undergone this massive effort to start to survey people to identify names to be placed on the list. So they've been coordinating the activities of a bunch of volunteers who are currently out in the community as we speak surveying homeless individuals. To aid in this effort, Social Services use a nominal amount of money in their budget to purchase gift cards to incentivize participation. And overall, we've been really, really pleased with the level of participation response that we've gotten on these surveys. As of today, like Jill noted, there's 205 names in the database. The database that we're using is one that was provided for free to us by the 100,000 Homes campaign. And it really gives us some good capacity to be able to kind of take a look at the folks who are being prioritized for housing and measure where they are so that we can then measure where they are 12, 24, 36 months from now once they've been housed. So not surprisingly, what we're finding is that a high number of them have reported time in various public service settings, including 80% have spent time in jail, 21% have spent time in state prison, 85% have some sort of diagnosed or maybe undiagnosed mental health issue. And something that may be surprising to some of us is when we're thinking of some of these folks, I think we tend to picture that they may be older. But we've got some people who are on the list and in the database who are under the age of 25. And so that really represents a really good opportunity to intervene early in somebody's life and to make a difference. And so that's what we're hoping to do with this program. So with that, I'm sure there's going to be some questions, but I'll restate the recommendations. The recommendations are to approve the three-year contract with TEMA for the 50 Now program, and then to authorize a budget adjustment to cover the cost of the first year of the program. It will be funded using social services realignment funds from the state, and we will include contract cost in the Department of Social Services budget for subsequent years of the program. And that's it.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Jackson. We do have a few questions, I believe. Mr. Hill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me preface my questions and remarks real quickly by saying that I agree with Emily and Jill about this being a long time coming, and that this is probably, in my estimation, you know, this is the hardest but probably the most important work that we can do in the community to address chronic homelessness, and certainly to address the community costs, the social costs that come along with it. You know, we get caught up in a lot of other efforts. One of the efforts I think that we're going to have to talk about at some point is going to be, because it was brought up by Jill, the incredibly scarce amount of housing units available for people who are homeless, because that scarcity goes all the way through to people who are working poor, to people who are working and still can't afford to. So there's a lot of issues related here. But some questions about the vulnerability index. Much is made of it. We don't have a copy of it. Is that something that can be provided? Because there's two, and some of these questions, you know, are just out there to you know, I'm not asking Laurel or anyone else to jump up. I don't want to put people on the spot. But because there's a little bit of an inconsistency where it says that the prioritization is going to be given at times to people who are at risk of dying on the street, and then at other times it says that those who cause the greatest community costs. And it seems the second one is really the one that we should be focusing on. Happily, we don't typically have, unlike certain places, I guess, where there's a different climate, people literally dying on the streets as much as we see in other places. So, and programs like this is really meant to try to put some folks that are causing a lot of the costs into housing and getting them. Some other questions, though, and maybe I'm not sure who can answer this, but so we have the 50 housing vouchers from Haslow, which is great. Have we identified 50? I know, well, you know, maybe right now we don't need to identify 50, but we do need to identify about, looking at your 17 housing units. Have we been able to identify? I know that's always the hardest thing, working with landlords, working with others. Have we identified, knowing, going into it, that if we're able to say, all right, here's the first 17 we want to focus on, and we've already agreed that this model needs to change from trying to case manage them and then get them into housing to getting them to housing and case management. So do we have 17 units that we've identified?
We have we have 10.
Okay.
And I think we'll have 17, though, in place during that first 9 months without any problem.
And, Jill, when do you think in actuality that first 9 months will begin? Meaning, like, when would we?
That's a great question. I think the first thing we have to do is hire people. So to be honest, if we get the signature, I will post these jobs today, and mm-hmm. and we'll start hiring the team. We may have some internal folks who might want to shift over to this program, but we really need to hire the team. We need to convene our first stakeholders meeting, which will happen in the next 3 weeks, and then we need to get the list also and really take that 205 and make sure we are really working with the first 50. But I think it's important to have more than 50, as I said, because there's fluidity to the list.
And are we going to are you and your staff and partners, are you going to commit towards doing everything you can to keep these folks? Because I know from experience that a lot of the folks that you're going to be looking at and you're going to be finding housing for typically are suffering from severe mental illness. Mm-hmm. And that can be we've talked about this when we've had discussions with our behavioral health folks, the difficulty of keeping people on medications. Mm-hmm. Actually, sometimes the biggest difficulty, and I've spoken to folks on your staff and folks on our staff about this in the past, is getting people to accept housing, which we don't want to let that be the thing that pushes us away, because the people who may not be willing to accept housing right now are often the people who are causing the greatest problems in terms of emergency room visits and other things. So you have a whole bunch of challenges there. Are we committing to basically, if we're identifying beginning at 17, getting housing for those 17, getting them in there to really sticking with those folks?
Yes. One of the numbers I can point to is in our transitional homeless housing program, we've had about 75% success after 2 years that they're still housed, which is pretty great, I've got to say, given some of the issues with the population. I fully expect that for some people it will take a year or two of us just talking to them and engaging and them remaining homeless. I mean, to be honest,
yeah.
I think that there are some people that it does take a long time for them to develop trust and rapport and be ready to engage in services.
So will we be, and that's an excellent point, actually, because I want us to be able to do that, to two things at once in that particular kind of instance, which I think you're going to encounter perhaps with more frequency than not, which is people who are refusing because, you know, we're linking the housing with case management and with the services. We don't want to put somebody in a housing unit with severe mental illness who's not going to be getting help of any kind because it's going to be a disaster. So there's people who may not be convinced, but so at the same time that we are getting, say, the 17 in the first part of it, and we know there's maybe five or six that are still resistant, but they're causing a lot of problems, we're still going to be sending people out to try to gradually convince them that, you know, we're going to help them.
That's right. One of the ways this model works, that sort of ACT model assertive community treatment, is that everybody knows everybody on the caseload. So there's some interchangeability. But yes, everybody would be, we would be reporting out on where everyone is within this process.
And then finally, Jill, for now, and I hope my colleagues will be comfortable with this, and that's why I'm asking you first. Because this is a significant commitment on our behalf, and because this is an issue that the county has been taking the lead on since the 10-year plan was first being drawn up, and because, quite frankly, I think this is really the first time that we're looking at something that's on the street effective, we have three objective points here, 9 months, 15 months, 21 months. I would feel very comfortable in an oversight role of bringing reports to the board to see where we're at. I think the community is so interested, obviously, the entire community from south to north, and we are looking at this in a way that's going to represent different parts of the community. So people who are homeless in South County, people who are homeless in North County, people who are homeless here in the central part of the county. If, you know, once you've commenced the sort of nine-month period, if at the end of that you could come to the board and basically give just a report on how things are going, where we're at, what objectives are being met, what are still difficult, and then the same with the 15 and the 21 months, because I think the public interest in this, as you know, is great. And the certainly the importance of this is high up there. Yes. Among, you know, if you talk to any electeds, it's an issue that continues to be, you know, plaguing our community at times, as every community. So would that be something that you
absolutely.
Think?
Absolutely. I think that that's a great idea, because I think it's just as important for you to know where we're really running into roadblocks as much as it is for you to hear about successes, which I fully expect there will be both.
Great, great. I appreciate that. That's all for now. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Hill, Mr. Meacham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jill, don't go away. I understand that this is a three-year project or proposal here, and are we going to be dependent upon realignment funding to continue this program, or is this going to be something that the county is going to have to look towards funding? And then I got a couple of questions that you can get them all at one time if you would. And based upon the first year of 17 folks that you want to get into a place, we're looking at about almost $35,000 per individual, if you will. What percentage of that could be allocated towards the housing issue? Because you referenced earlier the difficulty with the private sector and Section 8 housing. So I don't know what parameters you have to work with in that regard.
So let me answer your first question first. if I can. So I think some of the program may be able to be funded by other sources. I fully expect that if people move into the more traditional mental health system, let's say they've never been involved, that they will then be able to be part of that system formally and may move largely out of this program. So that might be an example. Now, I guess there's a decision that has to be made at some point. Do you keep at 50 and you keep adding people to that list? And that's probably a decision that you all have to make administratively about whether this is a rolling 50 over time.
I think a lot of that will be dependent upon how successful the program is.
Right. I think we have to also acknowledge this is a startup program, and so we are going to be learning along the way, and that's something that we've talked a lot about with the stakeholder group, and Emily and I have had lengthy conversations about it. So I think we're going to have to see how some of this goes, and if there are some actual savings. As Emily said, you're not going to lay off people in the sheriff's department because there are fewer people at the jail. Same with the Department of Social Services. They're still going to have their eligibility workers, even if we're able to do a better job of providing them benefits. So I think some people will be moving into the system, and some people will be moving out of the system and will be getting work and staying
staying on their Section 8 benefit and really probably getting out of the services element altogether. We have seen that experience on a regular basis. So I don't know about the realignment funding and general funds, but I do see that we could stick with this group of people over time and see how those costs shrink, or this is a decision that your board can make about maintaining that level and having it be an ongoing project. So I think those are the choices. Now, I'm going to have to ask you to restate your second question.
I'm wondering what type of flexibility you have when you're addressing the issue of Section 8 housing as opposed to the rent that we're going to, or the for the landlord that you're going to have to probably pay more. And then the other part of that, do you think that we're going to see a decline in Section 8 housing availability because of this?
Because of this project? No, I don't think so. Okay. I think a couple of things will happen as a result of this. We do have some funds. One of the things, I did research, obviously, in putting this together and talking to other colleagues who have Housing First programs and similar projects to this, and there are costs that need to be put in a project like this to sort of smooth out. We don't want landlords to be called for every little thing, for example. And so that's definitely part of what we're trying to do is make sure that, that we're helping to maintain that housing and so that the landlords don't see this as a big cost to them and that they are continuing to be motivated to be partners with the Section 8 program. So I think that that is important. And that's what we have a long history of doing. The private landlords we've worked with, we try to be under the radar as much as possible, and I think that that's what's been effective. But we probably will be doing some master leasing of housing in addition, just to make sure that we have that stable. I mean, that was one of the questions that Supervisor Hill asked, and I think that that's one of the things we want to make sure we ensure housing right from the get-go, so we have places for people to go.
Thank you. Ms. Arnold.
Yes. So this is such an exciting day for me. And I'll share with the public, a year and a half ago, a little more than that, when I came onto this board, I was asked to represent them on the Homeless Services Oversight Council and then to chair that council. So little did I know I was embarking on such a rewarding and challenging project as we're now, hearing about today. But it has been amazing. And at that time, Laurel, where I have to give you a little shout out, was relatively new to the county as well. And Laurel was coming to us with national experience on dealing with homeless populations, what worked, what hadn't worked. And she was really the one that introduced this 100,000 homes campaign to that body. Well, with all the wonderful people and partnerships in this county, the next step was to make this happen. And with Transitional Mental Health here with Jill and Capslow and the Housing Authority and everyone working together, this has been about a year and a half now in the organizational stage. So now with the Housing First model and using the 100,000 homes campaign, we're ready to go. And when we had the first presentation here, whether we could go forward or not, and I know Supervisor Meacham was asking about, our homeless resources being, it was really important to have those homeless resources available for families. But what this is going to do, and I know it's going to work, this is going to be a success, is taking, and we've heard Emily did a fantastic job presenting, but freeing up so many of our resources by addressing the 10% of our chronically homeless, the ill, the elderly, the people that, as Laurel says, could have the, there's a risk of them dying on the streets. Housing First, stabilizing them, wraparound services. I mean, I've learned a lot from you all this last year and a half, and it makes perfect sense to me that we're spending a lot of money on treatment, and then these folks are going back out on the street in the same, falling back into the same habits. It's our hope that the Housing First model will help stabilize them. The fantastic services that TEMA will provide will really be able to address their health needs, and we'll move on to the next 50 is what I hope, Jill. But anyway, I just want to thank you. This has been a fantastic experience working with you all, and I'm really excited. It's a very result-oriented effort that we're about to embark on, and I I hope we're back here in a year talking about how successful it's been. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Arnold. Ms. Ray.
Well, that's a perfect segue, and I first want to preface what I'm about to say with the fact that this is logical. I'm excited and definitely in support, but I have some questions.
Okay.
And it's with regard to the results and the milestones.
Okay.
And just keep in mind that I come from a background of professional assessment and that sort of thing. So our milestones, as I'm reading in the staff reports on pages 6 and 7, so there are milestones 1 through 10. For those of you at home watching, they're grabbing some for Jill. Okay, so looking at 1 through 10, if you look at 6 and 7, it measures across 50 clients, but the benchmark, I'm sorry, the standardized assessment tools measure over the total of 50, but the milestones don't hit 50 until 21 months. So we're measuring out of 50 in 12 months when that's not our milestone. So we're setting up our benchmark, or excuse me, our standardized assessment to fail.
I think I can address that initially, and Jill can add anything necessary. So what Haslow has told us is that based on their experience, they need to typically engage with about three people in order for one Section 8 voucher to be used. And so the idea here is that while we're looking at only housing probably 17 people in the first 9 months, we're going to be engaging with many more than that. And so there's a few things that we can do really early on to start to kind of increase the stability of these folks. And part of that is to screen them for case management so we can start kind of developing a plan for what is it that we're going to do at the point where we really start to engage with them. And then is also to enroll them and get them health care coverage through the Affordable Care Act. And so
6 and 7 then don't assume that 50 clients will already be housed. It's just that they're in the program.
That's
exactly.
Right.
I see. Okay,
right.
Thank you for that. And also, to that end, number 7 then, the threshold seems relatively low since the county is embarking on this effort as well, and that is to get them registered with the Affordable Care Act.
And it may be higher, and we hope that it will be. We're not going to stop at 30, certainly, but we thought that that was probably a reasonable and realistic measure given that, or target, given that this is such a difficult population to engage with. And so we've got to leave some room for the possibility that there are going to be folks who, when we engage with them, just don't want to have anything to do with it, at least initially.
Okay. And then lastly, on a much more optimistic note, what if this is a wild success and we get to 50 sooner than 21 months or within, remember these benchmarks say 21 months, but our contract is 3 years. What if we get to 50? Do we have the capacity to go over 50 or are we going to be back here? Or how would that mechanically work if this is as successful as we want it to be?
I thought you were going to say you were throwing the party.
I will. There you go.
Okay. So we've got a party commitment.
I think that's something that we'll evaluate at that time. I mean, we're planning to evaluate this day by day, really, since it is such a new program and such a significant investment of resources. But to get to Supervisor Meacham's question, we've committed to funding at least 3 years of this program, and we've identified realignment funds to be used for that purpose. If at the end of 2 years or at the end of the initial 3-year term, we determine this has been a wild success, which we're hoping that it will be, we'll make a decision at that point in time about whether or not this is something that TEMA and other partners would like to continue to be involved in and if it's something that the county would like to continue to be involved in. And I think that, we'll have to take a look at the budget at that time and evaluate, what funding sources may be available to assist in that effort, at least on the funding end.
Great. And to that end, I would certainly encourage us to add in that we would have three reports just after. Obviously, it wouldn't be 9, 15, and 21 months. So you'd have to have some time, but
yeah.
Right after each one of those benchmarks.
Yeah, we'd be happy
Absolutely.
To do that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ray. I think colleagues have touched on most of the questions that I had, but I wanted to dig just a little deeper into one and reinforce another. Taking off from Supervisor Ray's consideration of the benchmarks, the first 5 of them speak to 50% targets of reduction or retention or a number of those. I'm just curious, as you have experience, Ms. Bolster-White, on how those compare with known results elsewhere, for instance, Santa Clara County. I mean, those numbers, we have to choose a benchmark. We hope to make them. How are those benchmarks set? And, you know, what do we know about our probabilities here?
We actually set those more based on our own experience locally. Mm-hmm. And because, again, this is going to be a list of people who have very high vulnerability. So we've talked about some of the issues that they've had. There's a lot of chronicity of mental illness and drug and alcohol. So we actually set those slightly lower than the benchmarks that we have for people who came to us screened through the mental health department and had, or that we'd outreached and engaged into the behavioral health department. So I think that that's why we wanted to set what we thought was realistic, given that these folks are going to just have a higher degree of chronicity. They won't have been identified as mentally ill already, so they will be a little different. So that was how we set them, not looking at other communities.
Well, and understanding, as you referenced this, a startup project, I think it does speak to the role of oversight of this board in tracking meeting or exceeding or failing to meet these benchmarks and adapting. I think we're on a good footing there. The other component I wanted to speak to, I'll just reinforce the idea that since this is housing first, mm-hmm. a very careful management of the available housing stock is a key thing. I was very heartened in reading all the services that could be provided, the great collaborations, but there's a sort of a clerical function, an in-the-engine-room function of making sure that there are roofs to put folks under. That is key to the start of this whole thing. So, you know, to the extent that resources need to be deployed to assure that, I think that that's money well spent, because it then triggers all the other good things that can happen. So just a reinforcement on that. With that, I'll go to Ms. Arnold and then Mr. Hill.
Well, I was ready to, after a year and a half of preparation, move to adopt staff recommendation. I got out over my skis. I'm so excited about that.
We'll get back to you. Yeah. Mr. Hill.
Just to touch on your issues, Mr. Chair, and also Ms. Reyes, and I think this is important, too, and that's why I think it's coming back to us with good reports is important, because I think managing expectations is critical. You know, if we could design a program where they go after the 50 easiest, and then the success rate will be 100%, and we all feel good and pat ourselves on the back and really won't have accomplished a heck of a lot. So I'm less concerned. You know, I want to see, you know, I mean, whatever has to happen in terms of the, you know, the team that's working on this to make adjustments, to work to do this is really more important than, you know, and the fact that we don't give up on people regardless of how difficult. There's a lot of service-resistant homeless people out there, and if you've been in the creeks and if you've been under the bridges, if you've been in encampments and if you've been with severely mentally ill people, this is not a matter of just saying, okay, well, we have a unit over here and we put them there and we just check in on them. It's sometimes, especially with people who are in a serious situation, 24 hours a day for quite a while until there's a certain amount of stability. So I just want you to know that my concerns about the board reports are important for us to oversight and for the public to have continued information on now that we're embarking on a program that I think is really the most important program we should be embarking on. But I do want everybody, including you, I don't want anybody to feel like that there's that the benchmarks have to be met in order to satisfy the monies that are spent. I just want to see that the work that is done is continuing to be as effective as possible, adaptive as necessary, and those sorts of things, because, you know, I have a pretty good understanding of you know, of what you're up against. Mm-hmm. And at some point we'll have to have a discussion, as I said, too, about I think is much more important than some of the other things that we end up looking at, which is more units. I mean, you know, it would be great to have another Anderson Hotel. Mm-hmm. I don't know that we'd ever be able to create an Anderson Hotel today, but it's great that we have one, and we're going to need another one somewhere or something like that, or maybe, you know, finding one that exists. But those are things that, you know, that we might come back to at different points, too, when we find out about the, you know, even the difficulties of finding the housing. But I'm very much very heartened and very encouraged and very excited about us actually undertaking this. I look forward to those reports to the board, and I look forward to learning more, such as, you know, as you and all the folks working on this do.
Great. I guess I'll just say I promise to be as transparent, like I said, about the sort of the warts and wonders of this project. I don't want to oversell what the expectations are, but I also feel Joe Madsen is behind me. He's managed the homeless outreach team. He's done this work in the field. He's been working on the vulnerability index. He's responsible for the project. Well, I'm ultimately responsible, but I feel really good about the folks who we have in place and our experience, and I definitely will let you know how it's going along the way.
Great. Very good. Thank you, Ms. Bolster-White. I will go ahead and open it to the public. We'll start our public input with Ms. Elaine Archer, followed by Jana Nichols.
Hi. Good morning. I'm Elaine Archer, the Director of Housing Management for Haslow, and I'm excited to be here this morning and to ask for your support in approving this contract. We've been working with TEMA, as Jill said, for almost 20 years on supportive housing for chronically homeless populations, and we've seen terrific experience, a success in their experience in working with these groups. In November, as was mentioned, Scott pledged 50 housing choice vouchers to work with this program. And it has been our experience as the Housing Authority that individuals who are receiving wraparound services and supportive services do have a higher chance of achieving success in maintaining that housing and staying permanently housed. Our Board of Commissioners has approved a change in our administrative plan to allot these 50 vouchers for this 50 Now program, and we are ready to begin issuing vouchers by September 1st once individuals are identified. In addition, we are also excited about the work that is going to be done with landlords. Rental housing, in addition to many other types of housing, is limited and increasingly more expensive in this county. And we are going to be working in developing a group that is going to do a coordinated and collaborative approach to reaching out to landlords. We do increasingly hear from landlords, we can get more money on the open market, why should we take Section 8? We do look at our payment standards. Fair market rents are continuing to go up, and we do want to be competitive. And we want to collaborate with each other and educating landlords on participating in this program and educating them about the families that are in this program. And so we are excited to see that be part of this contract as well. So we encourage your support and thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Archer. Ms. Nichols, followed by Greg Herman.
Good morning, Jana Nichols with the Five Cities Homeless Coalition. I'm here also to support this project. I have been involved with the early discussion through HOC on the development of it, and we are very much looking forward to working with Transitions Mental Health Association and the team in doing this. As you know, folks who are facing mental illness are just one component of those who are homeless here in San Luis Obispo County. And I think it's important to recognize that there's a matrix of services needed to address the various challenges that folks are facing. Certainly, the Housing First model I am very much in support of, but I don't believe it's the only model. I do believe that taking this particular act with the 50 Now will allow us then to look again at some of the other services that we're also offering. This is a very difficult, chronic group that has been of severe concern to the community for quite some time. And I think the way this program fits into the matrix of services that are being provided is critical. I think making sure that folks are housing ready is also important. Certainly the shelter services that are being provided by ECHO and CAPSLOW are important for that. And I think that those services will be there will be some ability to lessen the load of some of the other challenges that they've had. The population that this particular 50 Now program addresses oftentimes are not those folks who are able to access those shelter services for a variety of reasons. They're not appropriate for congregate living situations, and as Supervisor Hill and others have mentioned, are very oftentimes very service resistant. In South County, we do not have a shelter, and so the services that are being provided are slightly different. We're going to be depending a great deal on this program, again, to identify those most vulnerable, but then we're also looking at a variety of rapid rehousing programs. The Supportive Services for Veterans Family Grant that is outstanding with the Veterans Administration will be one way to do that. We're also working with the Community Foundation to look at rapid rehousing services through the CLAPRA bequest. So I encourage you to support this. I can't think of a better organization to take the lead. TEMA has the experience and expertise and certainly community standing and relationships to make it work. So I encourage you to support, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Nichols. Mr. Herman.
Hello, everyone. My name is Greg Herman. I'm the Special Projects Manager for the City of San Luis Obispo. The city has sent along a formal letter in support of this item, and I'm here simply to echo those comments on behalf of the city. Addressing homelessness is a critical issue for our community and currently one of the major goals for the city. Considerable time and effort has been invested by individuals across our community and partner organizations to make continued progress on this important matter. The city's valued the ongoing relationship with the county in finding solutions to this complex issue, and we look forward to continuing that partnership with the 50 Now program, new homeless services center, and other initiatives that provide viable solutions to address homelessness in our region. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Herman. That was our last request to speak, so I'll close it to the public and bring it back to the board. With no further discussion, Ms. Arnold?
I'll repeat my motion. I'll move to adopt staff's recommendation.
Thank you. Do we have a second?
Second.
Thank you, Ms. Ray. Seeing no further discussion, Madam Clerk, we have a motion on the item as amended by Ms. Jackson's contract modification. A roll call vote, please.
Oh, hang on, just real quick,
yes,
for purposes of discussion, can we add in the three reports out at the three intervals?
Right. So the motion would be then to direct staff to return with reports at appropriate intervals. Very good.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
Ms. Ray?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
And Mr. Gibson?
Yes. Thank you all very much for your efforts put in there. We are going to declare a short break. We will convene again at 10 minutes after 11 o'clock. Fire us up, Madam Clerk.
All right.
Thank you, Madam Clerk. We are back in session. Would you please introduce our next item?
Item number 18, consideration of options related to the Pirates Cove Park and Cave Landing Trail Construction Project, District 3.
Ms. Black.
Good morning, Chair Gibson and members of the Board of Supervisors. I'm Curtis Black, Interim Director of Parks and Recreation. Today we have a report regarding Pirates Cove and Cave Landing Trail, and we do have a presentation, there we go, for your consideration and action. Here is an aerial view of the project site. You'll notice on Parcel 3 it includes the Cave Landing Trail portion of the project. That's in yellow. And then on Parcel 5, that included the parking area, all the drainage facilities, amenities, and then trails to the cave and the beach. As background, the initial funding came from the Department of Fish and Wildlife and was received. Various technical engineering reports were pursued from 2002 through 2010, and the county took ownership of these properties in 2008. From 2010 to 12, we received commitments for a combined $700,000 worth of grants from the SLOCOG and also the California Coastal Conservancy. By 2013, the Planning Commission had approved the coastal development permit for this project, which was then appealed to your board. And the board, your board approved the coastal development permit last November 2013. In July 2014, the California Coastal Commission reviewed this coastal development permit on appeal and took two actions. One, they approved the construction of the Cave Landing Trail portion on Parcel 3, and secondly, they denied the permit for work on Parcel 5, including the parking area, drainage facilities, all maintenance and construction activities for the project. The project options that we have before you today are to, number one is to withdraw the application for the coastal development permit and take no further action. In this option, existing grant funds would be returned to the granting agencies for redistribution. Potential project for this funding would include Pismo Preserve, Harford Pier, Avila to Harford Pier Trail, and expansion of the Central Coast Aquarium. A second option would be to pursue only the Cave Landing Trail per the Coastal Commission's approval. This would take approximately 2 to 3 years, and water runoff noted previously would be of real concern. The third option would be to return to the drawing board and attempt an entirely new project for both Parcel 3 and Parcel 5. Now, this would take approximately 3 to 5 years, for public input and the studies, and approvals for the Coastal Commission might be questionable. Concerns related to these options include recreational service levels, in that if we do create a trail in this area, we would certainly expect to see some new people visiting the trail, somewhat like Bob Jones Pathway began slowly and has become very, very popular. New visitors to the site would need a parking area, so they could. This could likely exacerbate parking problems that exist over in Shell Beach. That's just to the south of this area. Funding sources are also questionable, because if the county should decide to pursue either Cave Landing Trail or the entirely new project, continued public input processes, engineering, hydrology, archaeology reports would take 2 to 5 years, depending on the size of the project. Funding for two of the three grants for this project would expire in 2016, so additional funding would need to be located. Liabilities were also of concern if a project is pursued. That is, the county is immune from public liability for natural areas that are used for recreational purposes. However, if a project is pursued, the county would have to indemnify and hold harmless the California Coastal Commission as one of the conditions for the coastal development permit. In addition, Commission's actions denied the installation of the drainage facilities that were planned on Parcel 5. Without the drainage facilities, we cannot redirect stormwater runoff that will certainly occur as water runs downslope from Ontario Ridge towards the trail and towards the active landslide that's just below it on Parcel 5. Our recommendation for your board's action is to direct staff to withdraw the coastal development permit application for Pirates Cove Park and Cave Landing Trail construction project. Secondly, end efforts to construct the project. And thirdly, to remove this project from the park's priority project list. I'm finished with the staff report and available for any questions the board may have.
Thank you, Mr. Black. To the supervisor of the district, Mr. Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Curtis, could you put that concern slide back up? And a quick question to County Council, if we're getting this right. So the liability issue is that, as it stands now, we're not liable for any injuries or other incidents that might occur at Pirates Cove. But if we were to undergo a project without an indemnification from, say, the Coastal Commission, then suddenly the county would be liable for and potentially vulnerable to such lawsuits.
That's partially correct, Rita Neal, County Council. I think also the point that Parks was making with regard to the liability, that if we only did part of the project, the trail, and we sort of then own the liability for the part that we're not improving as well as part of that being connected. So mm-hmm. It's obviously we assume liability at all of our parks, but this would kind of be a hybrid and maybe a little more difficult.
Thank you. And I also, getting to this too, Curtis mentioned this, and I just spoke with Council Member Reese from Pismo Beach. I'm sure she'll address it. One of the ongoing issues in the area is the parking that creates quite a lot of problems for folks in Shell Beach, particularly on El Portal, the street that runs parallel to one of the entrances to the trail. And I don't think we would be doing any favors, for sure, to the city of Pismo if we went about one part of this project and then sort of left the folks that live there to have to deal with perhaps even I mean, essentially my view is, and I'm supportive of the recommendation and a little bit, you know, frustrated that things went the way they went at Coastal, which is there's other terrific projects in Coastal area for the funding for the Conservancy, and there's a lot of other things that our staff has to spend its time on. I know Curtis and his staff and the Coastal Conservancy staff spent a lot of time on this project, and I don't think that we, you know, I want to free up our park staff to do other things throughout the county rather than to figure out how we can dance on the head for the Coastal Commission. So I guess that's my remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Hill. Ms. Arnold.
Thank you. My question actually has to do with part of the staff report on page 3 where we read that the SLOCOG $350,000 grant for this project has some flexibility to it. I see Mr. DeCarli here in the audience, if maybe he could address that. It says in our staff report that SLOCOG has already taken action to move a portion of the grant funds to the Pismo Preserve project if the county is unavailable to complete the planned trail. So I just was wondering a portion.
Yes, recently the SLOCOG board did take action to move 50% of their grant, $175,000, contingent on your board's action today.
Correct. Thank you.
And Mr. Black, that's sort of along the lines of my questions. You know, if we choose to abandon this project in its entirety, we have other agency funding that will have to be returned. What is your guess on what that does to our relationships with those other agencies that are forthcoming?
We've had conversations with all three of the agencies. They well understand the situation that we were put in. We had a good project. It didn't move through Coastal Commission as we would have thought. And they've had good input regarding the potential for moving that funding, still keeping it local.
In the county to other projects. Very good. All right, with no other lights at the dais here, I'll go ahead and open it to the public. Mr. DeCarli, I have your slip up first if you'd like to amplify any comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Ron DeCarli, Executive Director of the San Luis Obispo Council of Governments. We are one of the partner agencies. There was reference in the staff report. We programmed through actions of our board, which includes all five members of the Board of Supervisors, $350,000 to go towards the California Coastal Trail. Basically, the Coastal Trail that was referenced in this report. So we were very, very disappointed with the Coastal Commission action that denied the vast majority of this project. And we concur. And really, at that, right after the Coastal Commission action, we came forward in discussions with the Coastal Conservancy to try and retain some of their funding and shift it from the parking lot to the trail. And they tentatively agreed to that, subject to actions of this board on the overall project. And at that time, we took a tentative action to our board at our August meeting to allocate $175,000 off this project in hopes we'd get Coastal Conservancy funding to be retained. And we took that funding and allocated to the proposed Pismo Preserve acquisition and access-related improvements. We now, after taking a look at your staff report, understand the legal concerns that's been raised. The question now, what happens with the balance of our funding? And subject to the action this board takes today, we'll either, one, keep the funding on this project, or two, reallocate the funding back into our cash balance for reconsideration in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. DeCarli. Next up, Parks Commissioner Pandora Nash Carner, followed by Christina Ensminger, as best I can read the slip.
Good morning, honorable board members, members of staff, members of the public. I'm Pandora Nash Carner, and this year's chair of the Park Commission. This was a brilliant project. We started talking about it on the commission in the year 2000. That's how long it's been going on. There was an enormous amount of work, and it was really good work. Staff did a great job, not only our staff, but some of the agency staff. The decision from the Coastal Commission is unbelievable because it was such a good project. So I, unfortunately, support option number one. I had talked to Curtis briefly about the possibility of a political marketing approach to try to change the opinion, but it doesn't look like the time is right to do that. So I want to thank the staff for their work and ask you not to drop it entirely, but put it on a back burner and revisit it when the political climate changes. So thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Ms. Ensminger, followed by Brian LeConte.
Hi, Christine Ensminger. I would like to give my time, my 3 minutes, to Brian LeConte.
And I'm afraid we don't cede time, so we're happy to take your comments. Each of the speakers will have 3 minutes.
Then I would like to reserve my space for the end of the meeting, please.
As you're at the lectern, if you would give us your comments, please.
We would like some trash cans. We support abandoning this project, but we do really feel that trash cans are important. And I think that's it.
Thank you, Ms. Ensminger. Mr. LeConte, followed by Gene Quayle.
That's a new one. Brian LeConte, District 3. The right thing to do is to build this trail. The arguments against it don't hold up to the facts. There is absolutely no reason that this trail can't be built as designed, because the water never was intended to go onto the parking lot, ever. You look at the details, it tells you the design intent, which there's an arrow pointing directly above the cave landing trail. What this was to do was to act as a huge speed bump, and the trail is sloped 2% downhill. So when you come up, it's 2%. When you're at the top, it's 2% going into the landslide. And when you're coming down, it's 2%. And when you're directly above the trail, it's 2%, all sloping to the landslide. There was never any need for the bioswells. Regarding liability, liability is exactly as it was before the Coastal Commission thing. The staff report correctly says if you do nothing, there is no additional liability. However, it fails to mention that the county is also equally unliable if it develops it and posts a sign to warn of any hazards. It's California Code 830 and 831, and that code was supported by Supreme Court ruling Hammond versus the United States. So, the Coastal Commission's liability was specific to the coastal hazards. This trail is already routed around the active landslide, so it is protective from any potential coastal hazards. Therefore, the county assumes no extra liability based upon the contingent. It's the height of irony that the parking is being brought up, so I'm not going to talk about that. The right thing to do is to build this trail. If you don't want to do that, that's fine. But please don't make your decision based upon what is being presented to you in the staff report, especially the item that a massive redesign is required that's going to take two to three years, and that by that time the grant funding would have expired. That is not the case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. LeConte. Mr. Quayle, followed by Mr. Bob Quayle.
Good morning, everybody. Gene Quayle from Grover Beach. No matter which of the options you choose, I would like to ask your help on one other thing. When the Coastal Commission denied anything to be done in the parking lot in Parcel 5, they did allow for trash pickup. I understand the reluctance in putting dumpsters there. I get that. As soon as you do that, they end up loaded with furniture and appliances and everything else. However, as one of the volunteers who does pick up trash, we have a problem. We've got nowhere to put it. We pick up a whole lot of undesirable stuff. Broken liquor bottles, half-filled food containers, cups of beverages that are all sticky and dumping all over. The trash bags that we fill up as you walk through the trails, they get holes in them from the brush or the broken glass. You take them back to your car, and you got to put that stuff in your car. Pretty soon, your car starts to look and smell like the back end of a garbage truck. So I'd like to ask the county to come up with a plan that twice a month you have a county employee, either the Harbor District or the rangers from the county park in Oceano, make a pass through the parking lot and pick up the trash bags that we fill up. It's asking too much for the volunteers to take that garbage home with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Quayle. Mr. Bob Quayle, followed by Bill Dineen.
My name is Bob Quayle. I had originally intended to cede my time to Brian, but since I'm up here, I would just like to support the comments that my younger brother made. So that's about all I have to say.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Quayle. Mr. Dineen. And don't worry about the microphone. Stand tall. It'll pick up whatever you have to say.
Thank you. My name is Bill Dineen. I am 90 years old. I've been going to Pirates Cove for 50 years. I've run on the beach probably a total of over 650 miles when I was doing marathons, which I no longer do. My advice to everyone, don't get old. And I don't know how you can avoid it. I love the beach. I love the trail up above. My son and grandson and I go along that trail up above. It is wonderful. I would not like to see in so-called improvements, and I do go along with your recommendation of not putting improvements there. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Dineen. That was our last and, as always, most unique request to speak. So I will close it to the public and bring it back to the board. Mr. Hill, would you like to lead off? Supervisor Meacham.
Let Mr. Meacham. Just quickly, Mr. Dineen, I guess the opposition to not growing older is rather grim. But what could we do in terms, Curtis, in terms of the trash issue? And I understand that these folks are concerned about trash, and it's unfortunate that a lot of volunteers have to go pick up after stupid. So what can we do?
Well, we do appreciate Gene's group that goes down the Whales Cave Conservancy and all of the litter patrol that they do. Litter patrol is the one thing that the Coastal Commission will allow us to do. They will not allow us to place a trash can down there on Parcel 5. Not a trash can, not a sign about the bluffs, nothing to smooth out the parking lot, nothing. We can schedule, if we get the timing correct, the dates when you're going to do the litter pickup, we can make sure that one of our rangers drives by with a pickup truck so that those bags can go directly into the pickup truck. That way, then the seagulls won't pick them apart, you won't have to carry them in your personal vehicles, and we won't be violating Coastal Commission's actions. So I think that would take care of it.
Great. If anything we can do, I think it'd be greatly appreciated.
Mr. Hill?
Yeah, and with that, Mr. Chair, and I would encourage then Mr. Quayle and others, and we do appreciate the work that folks do to keep the beach clean and such. So if you could coordinate with Parks on litter pickup, as you heard from Mr. Black, we'll send our truck out to do that. But we need to coordinate. But with that, I do move that we recommendation one, direct staff to withdraw the coastal development permit application for Pirates Cove Park and Cave Landing Trail Construction Project.
Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you, Ms. Arnold. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, then, Madam Clerk, roll call vote, please.
So that is just recommendation number one.
Option one?
Correct.
Not two and three. Okay.
Correct.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Ray?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes. Thank you. And Mr. Black, at some point we're going to hear a formal discussion of what other projects might benefit from available funding on that.
Absolutely. The two that you are
saw on consent today would be likely candidates. They have a lot of work headed for them at both Templeton to Atascadero Connector and the Morro Bay to Cayucas.
Very good. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. With that, Madam Clerk, would you introduce our last item, please?
Item number 19, consideration of a request by the Land Conservancy of San Luis Obispo for $400,000 of additional county funds to assist in the purchase of the Pismo Preserve, and if approved, authorization of a budget adjustment in the appropriate amount from general fund contingencies to Parks Land Fund Center 30504, District 3.
Very good. Mr. Buckshy.
Yes, good morning. Dan Buckshy, County Administrative Officer. I will briefly introduce this item, given that your board received an update just a few short months back and that a lot of members of the public here are very familiar with this project. I'll keep the staff presentation rather short. What is before us today is an effort by the Land Conservancy to preserve approximately 900 acres of open space just east of the city of Pismo Beach, which is being known as the Pismo Preserve. The total cost is approximately $12 million. Back on May 20th, your board allocated just over $1 million, $1.1 million to be exact, of public facility fees from parks to this project. The Land Conservancy has been very active and has raised $11.5 million of the $12 million total. Numerous governmental agencies, state agencies, and private individuals have donated. I believe the timing to close this deal is the end of this month, so a few short days away, and the Conservancy has made a request to your board to fund $400,000 of the remaining $500,000, and I believe that they're well on their way to raising the other $100,000 that would be needed to close this project out. And with that, I would hand it over to Ms. Kyla Detman to provide a little more information for your board.
Welcome, Ms. Detman.
Thank you, Chairman Gibson and members of the board, and thank you, Administrator Buckshy, for your introduction. Yeah, it's a very exciting week for us. I'm Kyla Detman, Executive Director of the Land Conservancy of San Luis Obispo County. I, frankly, have been completely surprised, honored. I knew this was an amazing project, but the support we have received from people from throughout the county has just been phenomenal. And it's a very proud moment for me today to be here before you asking for the county to finish this out. You guys set the stage with your $1.1 million award back in May. It sent a strong message to the state when we went up there just a week and a half later to ask for their $4 million from the State Coastal Conservancy. And you guys really set the tone for us being able to make this project happen. And I'm just really grateful to be here before you today with this request. As a side note, and I think I know Adam knows this, but our organization's membership alone has increased from 750 households to over 1,400 households in this county just through this project. And what that does is it sets the stage for our organization to take it from here with the momentum we've gotten from the Pismo Preserve and focus our efforts on other parts of the county as well. One of our trustees came up with a great saying of on to the Adelaide, because we have several major ranches up in the North Coast and North County that are excited to work with us moving forward for conservation easements and the like. So there's more here than just this one amazing project. It's really setting us up for more success throughout the county. And yeah, it's just an exciting time. Also, we haven't sent out the press release, but the Land Conservancy, as of last week, was formally accredited by the Land Trust Accreditation Commission. We received word on that. They set the standards nationally for excellence. It's a rigorous auditing process, and it's just amazing to have that happen at the same time that we're wrapping up the Pismo Preserve. I hope that it instills confidence in your board and people throughout the county that the work we're doing is the highest caliber and extremely professional, and that we will be around for years to come to care for the Pismo Preserve into the future and provide that as an amazing amenity for our community and for the people that we serve. As a mom, as a resident of San Luis Obispo, yeah, it's just amazing to see this happening, and I'm here for any questions you have. I don't want to take up a lot of your time today because I know you guys know the project well, and you've heard from me a lot. I really, really hope that you'll take this action today to finish out this project, and we'll be wrapping it up at the end of this month with close set for the first couple weeks of September. We'll be done with this deal, so thank you so much.
Very good. So moving on, Mr. Hill and then Ms. Arnold.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question, Kyla. So if the board is able to grant this request today, that means that you'll be able to close the deal and also and with some of the money that we even saw from SLOCOG in here and some of the money that's still coming in happily from the community, be able to do the parking lot infrastructure stuff to get it open for next summer. Is that the anticipated schedule?
Yeah, our plan would be to do construction in construction season next year, assuming we get all the permits, but we're already actively working on that. We'll still receive funds. People, if you guys close it out today, there's donors out there that are still sending in checks, and if there's any money raised above and beyond our original goal, that'll be wisely used towards creating, getting it open, and getting that parking lot set and making it as welcoming as we want it to for the public and visitors. So.
Right. Excellent. Thank you. Ms. Arnold?
Kyla, thank you for being here. And the question that I had was about that SLOCOG money. Has that been figured in already into your totals? I know you're asking for this $400,000 as the last necessary step. Have you already added that? Because it was kind of contingent on what we just did 5 minutes
right.
ago, I wasn't sure
right.
you were able to.
We, I'll start with something where it happened.
Thank you.
Right. So just to clarify, SLOCOG money only for amenities related to transportation, not for acquisition of the
equipment. Yes, because it's reimbursable and restricted to that activity. We couldn't really count it towards the actual acquisition cost.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. Stand by. We've got a number of requests to speak. We'll start with Parks Commissioner Nash Carner again, followed by Pete Jenny.
Good morning again, Honorable Board, members of staff, and the public. I'm Pandora Nash Carner from the Park Commission. There's no doubt. This is an incredible project of opportunity. 2.1% of your contingency general fund account is what's being asked for a project that will eventually come back to you 100-fold. It's going to provide benefits, generate revenue, increase tourism, use of services, additional TOT, et cetera. But most importantly, it puts us on the map in California. One more benefit for people to come to this county. We can compete now with Monterey and Santa Barbara counties, but this is one more feather in our cap to say, come here and stay longer. Visit the castle, visit the wine country, stay an extra night, go hiking. So we really support this. We support you in supporting this, and we ask you to grant the $400,000 to make this project happen. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Jenny, followed by Stacy Smith.
Good morning. Pete Jenny. I'm a member of the Board of Trustees of the Land Conservancy. I will be uncharacteristically brief for those of you who know me. I just want to...
Thank you, Mr. Jenny.
thank you very much.
Yeah.
No, I just want to reinforce a comment from your staff report, able to be prepared by the administrative office, and reinforce this notion that this action will help to provide a unique parkland suitable for hiking, biking, equestrian, and passive recreation at no ongoing cost to the county. And I know back in the old-timey days when I was directing your park program, we were always looking for partnerships that we relieve the county from that ongoing maintenance expense. And this is a wonderful opportunity. The $400,000 that you could contribute to put us over the top today is going to be paid in dividends that you will not have to pay because you will not have the responsibility for basically operating an additional park for the county's use, not to mention all the visitors. So I urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jenny. Ms. Smith, followed by Gary Kirkland.
My name is Stacy Smith. I'm the Conservation Project Manager at the Land Conservancy, but I'm also a resident of Arroyo Grande with three rambunctious small children and a small itty-bitty backyard. And, we spend most of our day awing at the site of the stucco building next to our house. But it's incredibly heartwarming and exciting to be able to just hop over the hill and get on the Pismo Preserve and be able to enjoy it with my children, and I'm excited for that, one of which is an 8-year-old who loves to ride horses, and I just can't explain to you how incredibly I'm excited for her to be able to ride her little pony Dolly up on the hills of the Pismo Preserve and see the great views up there and be inspired. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Smith. Mr. Kirkland, followed by Kara Woodruff.
As usually the case, I'm the fly in the ointment. I'm opposed to the county spending this kind of money for a
private preserve that people could buy. If people want this badly enough, they should be able to raise the money from citizens all over the world who wouldn't want to come here, instead of sticking it to the taxpayers of the state of California, the county, and of the nation. If the money is coming from government agencies, that means taxpayers are funding this, and the taxpayers need relief. Our country is now $17 billion, more than that, in debt. And if we have extra money, it should go back to those taxpayers or paying the debt. There are plenty of people in this county and in this nation, in this state, who could easily afford to give enough money to buy this preserve, which I'm not opposed to. I'm opposed to the county spending hard-earned taxpayer money. If they have a surplus, that means we're overtaxed. And therefore, volunteers and anyone should be able to donate to this, and there's plenty of money in this world to pay for it without forcing people to pay for it through their hard-earned taxes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kirkland. Ms. Woodruff, followed by Pismo Council Member Mary Ann Reese.
Good morning. I'm Kara Woodruff, and I'm a proud member of the Board of Trustees of the Local Land Conservancy. I want to say thank you for your past support of this project. We have just a short amount of time to close this deal, and if you vote yes today, we're done. We'll go to Sacramento, hopefully receive the last chunk, and we'll open it in the public within a year. It's a great benefit to the locals and residents, great for commercial tourism, et cetera. Thank you so much, and look forward to seeing you on the trail.
Thank you, Ms. Woodruff. Councilmember Reese, followed by Sheila Blake.
Thank you, Chair Gibson. I'm here not only as a council member from Pismo Beach, but as a resident of the county and a resident of the third.
An added attraction to the logical stopover equidistant from Los Angeles and San Francisco. Even the most simple-minded marketing consultant can't go wrong promoting the university, the wine tasting, the beaches, the hotels, the outdoor activities, and the easy access to all of these things. What are you waiting for? You'll get your names on a plaque. Please, make this contribution as your legacy. Make this contribution as your legacy to the county and all of us who live here. Thank you for your time.
A compelling case. Thank you, Ms. Blake. Ms. McDermott, followed by Bill Dineen. Followed by Christopher Hellenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I would like to say how impressed I am with the Land Conservancy. They have done a stellar job on this. This is a win-win-win for all of us. I'll be very brief. I encourage you to go ahead and make the donation, and we're looking forward to the party. Thanks.
Thank you, Ms. McDermott. Mr. Hellenius, followed by Bill Dineen.
Chair, members of the board, I'm Chris Hellenius, Avila Beach, president of the Land Conservancy's Board of Trustees. I just want to thank you all, especially Adam Hill, Karen Ray, for your leadership on this issue this last few months. This is an amazing feat that's being accomplished here. We only signed the option agreement 5 months ago to buy this. The idea of raising $12 million to bring this into effect is a daunting task. It just defies imagination that a rural county like ours can accomplish something so magnificent in such a short period of time. You guys are in the perfect position to provide the capstone funding for this project, and we welcome your support in the past. We look forward to it here today. Thank you so much. There's just way too many people to thank for all this, but I want to especially thank our staff. We are blessed with a fantastic staff of young, visionary, dynamic people who've led this organization through this process. Without them, we could never have accomplished what we have done here, and you will do today. Thank you. One last thing, I want to reiterate what Kyla said, and that is we are very focused on doing a lot of work up in the North County. Sorry. One last thing. I wanted to say that this project is the beginning of a five-year period for our organization where we will be doing many projects in the North County, really spectacular projects. I don't want any of you to think that we're just focused on South County or San Luis Obispo. That's not the case. We are working on the Atiyah Ranch up in North County, which is an 8,000-acre property, and we are working on the Eagle Ranch in Atascadero. We've got a number of projects in the Cambria area. It's really exciting what is on our books. Help us get that five-year period launched here today.
Thank you, Mr. Hellenius. Mr. Deneen, followed by Jose Esparza.
My name is Bill Deneen, and I would first like to compliment Herb Kandel for his leadership on this wonderful program to protect some of our wonderful natural area. I have already contributed, and I will now contribute another $100, and I urge other people to contribute to give the by the end of the month. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Deneen. Mr. Esparza, followed by Marshall Ohilski.
Good morning. My name is Jose Esparza. I'm an incoming student at UCLA, and I'm also part of the Nipomo High School Conservation Club. And I'm here to emphasize the importance of funding this purchase of the Pismo Preserve because of the various recreational activities that could be beneficial to the community, the San Luis Obispo County, and also, most importantly, because of I can't emphasize this enough, but because of the education towards the youth and for them. Now, I just want to talk about the educational opportunities that this could bring. Thinking back to my junior year in high school, my AP environmental class, we were learning about soil and the compounds in soil and dirt and everything. And we had to read this textbook that was very boring, I should say. But then when our teacher brought us out to the fields, to where we play and everything, he taught us about soil and everything, all the components to it. Outside of the classroom, it was so much better. We got to learn a lot better, and we actually learned by doing instead of just reading. So now, going up to the Prisma Preserve and hiking everything, there's a numerous amount of high schools, elementary schools, to a close proximity to.
Thank you. Marshall Ohilski. As I think all of you know, I'm from Los Osos, not from the area over there. But I do want to speak in support of this because I think that it's really, really a magnificent opportunity that's going to benefit the entire county. I have had a number of clients that have made contributions to this endeavor, and we are totally in support of this. City of San Luis Obispo sees the benefit countywide by their contribution last week, so I would encourage you to go ahead and move forward with this. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ohilski. That was our last request to speak, so I'll close it to the public and bring it back to the board. Mr. Hill, would you like to start us off, or you can defer to colleagues?
I'll defer to colleagues, right. And then I'll
Ms. Ray,
back.
Followed by Mr. Meacham.
We're all reaching for that button so fast. This, I'm going to be really brief. First of all, I'm so glad we had a student, even though you're technically not a student anymore, but you're going to UCLA, which makes me even happier. Our District 4 kids going there. This is a legacy vote. I cannot tell you what a privilege it is to make this vote. This is a forever vote. We don't make very many of these. So, again, we've all said it. This is going to make us a world-class destination. This is going to preserve this for my great-great-great-grandkids. It brings me to tears to say that. So I can't wait to vote.
Thank you, Ms. Ray. Mr. Meacham?
I'm going to give you a...
Yeah. you're very sensitive. You're very sensitive, Mr. Meacham. Thank you.
Well, I think that one of our jobs is to represent the entire county, trying to find ways to make this a better place. And often we have not done that. I think, and this is an opportunity to do that. I think that this is going to, as Karen mentioned, it's going to be a place that will be for generations to come. And I look forward to working with you in the North County and other areas to further preserve other areas that I think that can be of tremendous benefit to this county. When I became a supervisor here, I've lived here all my life. My family's been here for generations. And I didn't see a lot of the areas of this county until I became a supervisor. This county is pretty special, and it's pretty unique, and one in which I think this gives us an opportunity to further that. So I appreciate all of your efforts on that, and I'll be very supportive.
Ms. Arnold?
Thank you. So I'm not taking lightly the spending of tax dollars. We've already allocated $1.1 million, and now we're about to allocate another total of $1.5 million. And I know that, you know, in the county we have other needs for this unrestricted money. And the other consideration I always have when I see these kinds of things about to take place, I'm always a little bit sad to see productive agricultural ground taken out of production. But in this case, I see this as a wonderful opportunity to support the creation of a park in a very appropriate place for that. This is just a beautiful scenic piece of property that doesn't have so much production value as it really does parkland value, I think. I'm happy to see the Land Conservancy taking ownership and opening it up to the public. It won't be one of those parks that has its doors closed to the county citizens all the time. I'm confident that because of its location, it'll be quite an attraction to tourists and really enhance their experience when they come here to visit visit the county. And again, you know, it'll provide for generations. It'll provide a wonderful experience. It's a beautiful piece of property, and I think our citizens here in the county will really benefit for years to come from this acquisition. So I'm fully in support of the allocating the extra funding needed.
Thank you, Ms. Arnold. Those listening carefully, I think, have a sense of exactly where this is going. as it should. Let me only reiterate, as I did in May, how incredibly proud I am of the Land Conservancy. Ms. Detman mentioned their accreditation. That, in and of itself, not a small thing. But from that quality has come vision and leadership and commitment to a special place, which is the hallmark of that organization and has been for many years. Beyond that, the Land Conservancy has been able to inspire the community it serves. And that is key to their long-term success. As Ms. Detman said, they're going to be around for a while, technically in perpetuity. And that kind of commitment depends on the strength of the community. That partnership between a great organization and a great community has impressed those outside our county, as the state is coming forward with $8 million to make this real. And so what we see here is a classic success of land conservation, of doing the right thing, of supporting community values, and I am immensely proud to be sitting on this dais as we come.
Folks from the Land Conservancy better than I had before by participating in this, and it's just been incredibly heartening. I think Mr. Hellenius said it best, which is, you know, we get this done, and we have this wonderful jewel open up next year, and then it's onward to other parts of our county to do more great things. And that's just such an encouraging prospect. And if you've been on trails, if you lately in our community, you know that they're packed. You know, especially in South County, you know, the Ontario Ridge Trail, the Johnson Trail. I mean, all these trails are packed because people love to be outside here because it's so wonderful. And so this will help to relieve some of the traffic on the trails and provide brand new experiences for people who visit here and brand new experiences for our community. And when you talk to people in the accommodations industry, the tourist industry, they say that trails are really the future of our community in terms of bringing more people, because people come here because they want to be outside doing things. And this is a great opportunity because, you know, people are able to ride horses and mountain bikes and hike up there, and it's just going to be such a nice thing to be part of. And so with that...
Second.
I moved that, seconded by my South County colleague, with the of course, the instructions that our council was kind enough to provide.
Wait. Is the clerk clear on the motion? Without making any assumptions. The clerk
yes.
is clear on the
yes.
motion. We have a motion by Supervisor Hill, seconded by Supervisor Ray. Madam Clerk, a roll call vote, please.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Ms. Ray?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, ma'am.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
And Mr. Gibson?
Yes. Thank you. Well, we have one... Ladies and gentlemen, thank you. We have one more bit of business to conduct on the dais.
Wait a minute.
Here.
We're never going to see that again. Keep it coming.
Yes, right. Yeah. Before we go out and revel in this success, we do have closed session. I do not have any requests to speak on closed session, so I will close it to the public and ask counsel for an estimate.
Approximately 20 to 25 minutes.
And today. We will report out after that. AGP is excused, and we are otherwise complete with our open session.